Verse 26. Om Parataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Pratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayanim Ambatvamanusantabhami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvaishini. Mukta Sango Naham Vadi, Mukta Sango Naham Vadi, Vichyut Sahasamanditaha, Vichyut Sahasamanditaha. Siddha Siddhjor Nirvikaraha, Siddha Siddhjor Nirvikaraha, Karta Sattvika Uchyate, Karta Sattvika Uchyate. Mukta Sangaha, Anahamvadi, Vritti Utsaha Samanvitaha. Siddhi asidyoho nirvikaraha karta sattvikaha uchyate. This is, I think we might have touched on this last week, but anyway, we're going to do it. The sattvika karta, so this is, we're doing the karta, the doer, the one who has the kartrutvam buddhi. Kartrutvam buddhi means the sense of doership, right? So the ahankara is identified with the body, mind, sense organs, and takes itself to be an agent. That's the karta. Okay, so the karta, the sattvika karta, means for that karta, the buddhi is sattvic, right? And so the doer, what is the type, what is the nature of the doer, or the one who has this doership, when the buddhi is sattvic, when the mind is sattvic? So he describes that kartrutvam, that sense of doership, the attitude of doership for such a person. Mukta Sangaha. So for that person, the Sangaha, this attachment is Mukta, one who's freed from attachment. Attachment, Sangha, means that my being has to have this in order for me to be happy. That's Sangha, is attachment. And so how does that play out? First of all, one of the meditations we do on the Atman, yourself, is asangoham. I'm actually asanga. Asanga means no matter what is going on in the world or my body or my mind, whatever raga dveshas or anything that might be there, any emotions that might be there in my mind, myself is continually asanga. It is not changing in any way in the presence of all of these types of experiences that we have. And so if the Atma is asanga, if I recognize that asanga nature, a negates sangha, right? In Sanskrit, the a will negate. So if my nature is asanga, by nature free from any type of attachment, means nothing sticking to me, right? Nothing changes my being. Once I know that, then I'm a mukta sangha, right? I'm free of any kind of attachment because, not because of any activity on my part, but because I am free from attachment by my nature. So being mukta sangaha, being one who is a mukta, I'm a person who is mukta sangaha. Mukta means liberated from, freed from. I'm freed from by my nature because of my knowledge, actually. I'm free from any type of attachment. So the kartrutvam, the sense of doership, is only going to be mithya. Right? Because for me, actually, there is no doership, there is no attachment at all. So, also, being that mukta sangaha, anahamvadi. Ahamvadi means one who is very concerned about themselves. You know, their vadi means a vadin, like any different philosophical system is called a vadin, a vada, right? And so here, the vada the philosophical system, or, you know, what gives, what my mind rotates around is me, the ahamvada, right? So the anahamvada means that that type of arrogance or self-centeredness is not there, you know, where it's not all rotating around me. I'm not usually even thinking about that. I'm thinking about what is to be done here, what is here to be done. That's the anaham, that un, if the noun begins with a vowel, un negates it. So ahamvadi, anahamvadi, right? So the one who doesn't have that arrogance or self-centeredness. Then another, remember this is all around the kartatvam, doership. I don't have a need for something to be a certain way because myself is stable. It's not as though I'm going to be improved. I have a stable self, so I don't need these attachments. Whether something is here or something is not here, I remain the same. Myself is not going to be, it doesn't require arrogance. Your being doesn't require arrogance. Any amount of arrogance or lack of arrogance doesn't touch you, yourself, with your arrogance or high opinion of yourself, all these things. Nothing happens to your being. You know, your being is not capable of becoming dejected or inflated. And so this type of thinking is not, it's just, is irrelevant. It's irrelevant to who you are. So also, the person, this person has dritti and utsaha, samanvita. They're in, samanvita means that person is endowed with dritti, means resolve. And utsaha means the enthusiasm to carry something out. You have the capacity to commit to something. If there's something that needs to be done, or as your prarabdha karma unfolds, there are certain things that are there to be done. Your mind has the clarity and ability to make a resolve to go through with that, and then have the utsaha. Sometimes utsaha is called like the enthusiasm or the ability to say stay with something, like if you have, there's an idea that comes of that something that is to be done, and so you make a resolve to do that, but the resolve only lasts for a few days or even just a few hours. So the utsaha, that kind of energy that it takes to follow through on a resolve or a commitment, you know, is not there. So you need both, the dritti and the utsaha. So samanvitaha is the one who has that, both of those. One time Swamiji, was interesting, when we were talking about buying this, getting this property, the farm, so I was not knowing whether to do that or not. I made some, I wouldn't even say it was doubts. I just wasn't ready to say, okay, I'm going to do that. So Swamiji just says, he says to me, you just do it. Do it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. He said, but he said, do it. And then he said that, because he had that commitment for it. So he said, no, you just do it. Go ahead, just do it. He said, okay, I'll do it. And then he said, that's what I always do. He said, when something comes clear to me, I want to do something, it's there to be done, then I do it. But then he said, and I was wondering if now, I'm wondering if he was thinking of this verse. Because he does it, and then he follows through. He just sees it in his mind. This is how he described it to me. And he sees it in his mind, and then he just holds that. That's what he does. So I thought that was so interesting and so useful. He sees it in his mind, he holds that vision, and he does it. That's what he's talking about, this dritti utsaha, you know? It made it so clear when he was telling me that. He said, you do it like that. He said, do it like that. And it made so much sense to me. I'd really not heard something like that put into words. You know, he said that's how, but he was saying that's how you have a vision, keep that vision, and you just hold that vision in your mind and you do it. So
you did it.
Well, we have the farm anyway. Mm-hmm. So anyway, then the next thing that this says is siddhya siddhyoho nirvikaraha. And so for such a person, the sattvika karta, okay, also this vikara, vikara is a modification. Your mind doesn't, that person, for such a person, the mind doesn't go through these modifications. Nira means free of. Nirvikara. It's free of these modifications or worries of concerns about being successful, siddhi, or asiddhi. The mind is not concerned about being successful, or failing. You have a vision. This is what's to be done here. You know, you hold that in your mind and you go ahead. And if it fails, it's failed. It's bubble. You know, I remember, again, Swamiji's always an example for me. One time in the course on the East Coast, we must have been doing it for about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. Now it's been 25 years. It's well established, or 28 years I think it is now. But now it's a well-established and well, relatively well-funded. But it didn't used to be like that. It used to be like there was only enough money in the coffers for the next day. And Swamiji never bothered about that. He never even thought about it, actually. He just did what was to be done. And the money always came, but we didn't have any big bank account by any means. And he also ran courses like that in India, where there was no big bank account. There was just money coming in and money going out. And as it was needed, it came in and it went out, just like that. So I used to be in charge of all the finances, so I knew every day. I used to give him a daily report. I had a little computer program that kind of just printed it out, and that's one thing I would present to him every day, and then he would kind of know where we were. And it never bothered him at all. It used to bother other people tremendously, like the board members and people who were trying to do construction. It was very worrisome for them because we're going through with all of these big plans and there's no money to pay for it. And most people would like to have the money in the bank first. Mm-hmm. And then you do the things. And Swamiji never felt that way. But the things, you know, we're doing good work and it'll bubble and take care of it. You know, and then it'll come, it'll be fine. So everybody else, most people, couldn't. And then I remember at one point some of the people were getting worried, even though we'd never, even in India, never didn't pay our bills. Our bills they're always paid. But, you know. So one day he just said, because people were getting too concerned about things, he said, if it doesn't work, we're doing good work here. If it doesn't work, you know, we'll just sell it and I'll go back to India. There's no problem. And he got up and he went upstairs. You know. But actually, that is the truth. And it kind of shocked everybody because then everybody, no, Swamiji, everything, it will work, everything will be fine, no, we're not worried, everything will be fine. but it was just, the way he said it, I don't know how to repeat it exactly, but it was kind of like, we're doing this work, we're doing a good work, if it doesn't work, if Bhagavan doesn't want this, you know, then it will fold, you know. And I'll go back to India and do something else. That's it. There's no concern about it because you're already doing everything that there is to be done. So if you're doing, you know, that's the same thing. I do what he says, I do what is right in front of me, what is there to be done to the best of my ability. That's what I do. Every day, I do what is in front of me to the best of my ability. Now, what more can you do? See what I mean? What more can you do? And so if that's what you're doing, you're not going to be concerned about success and about failure. You're already doing your best. And so then if there's if something falls apart or something doesn't work out, then you have to handle that. So your mind's not going to be preoccupied with success and failure. It's going to be just doing what is there to be done. And that's not really even about you. That's why that anahankara is there. That's not really about you. That's about your participating fully in what needs to be done right now. See what I mean? And so that kartritvam is sattvika. It's really Ishwara. The jivatvam is not really very much present in that type of an attitude. Right? You're more like present to Ishwara. You're more like participating in Ishwara. And so the ahankara with its raga dveshas, its likes and dislikes, its needs, is not really manifest in that with that attitude. So remember, in the 16th, 17th in this chapter is mostly about these differentiating all of these types of attitudes. The sattvika attitude is the attitude of the karma yogi, right? What is the sadhana? The sattvika attitude is what is sadhana for the karma yogi, for the mumukshu, and what is natural for the jnani. But that's why for the mumukshu, sometimes Swamiji will joke, it's, you know, fake it till you make it. But it's not, that's a joke. You're supposed to laugh at that one, fake it till you make it. But faking it, it's not faking it. Faking it means your emotional system is committed to living up to your values and to your knowledge. Mm. Right? Mm. Instead of the emotions and the fears and the baggage that we bring with us, instead of those being what we follow, instead the mind is being guided by and ruled by your knowledge and by your understanding. And so when we say fake it till you make it, what we're saying is that I'm feeling this way, but I'm going to act this way. Yeah? I'm feeling frightened, or I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling whatever, hurt, but that's not the way I want to respond. That's not the way I want to act out in the world. And so I'll work on these emotional pressures that might be there. I'll work on them, do inner child work, or do all kinds of different work to help those attitudes mature. But those are not the attitudes that I'm going to act out in the world. The attitudes that I'm going to act out in the world are something which resonate with my understanding and with my value system. So that's the idea there. So whenever we're doing the sattvika, those are the values that we're trying to live up to. The rajasa and tamasa values, they're not values exactly, you know, but those, Krishna is going through all of those so that we can recognize them as they occur in our mind. So we have a label for them. So this is what that is. So it's a viveka. It's just a way of, it's a viveka, it's a discrimination to help us understand the different ways our mind can work so that we can transform the ones that are producing a lot of problems and pain, basically. Yeah? And they're not rooted in any type of reality. That's the thing. They're rooted in ajnanam. They're rooted in self-ignorance. And so we have to recognize those so then we can do something about them. Otherwise, they're just in the background ruling us. Right? We don't have any objectivity over them because we haven't brought them into consciousness to recognize them for what they are. So that's the idea. So he says, so such a person, karta sattvika uchite, that person, that type of doership is called sattvika. Okay? Now he does the rajasa. So that verse 27. Raji karma palat plepsuhu. Raji karma palat plepsuhu. Lubdho himsatmako shuchihi. Lubdho himsatmako shuchihi. Harshashokan vitak karata. Harshashokan vitak karata. Rajasav parikirtitaha. Rajasa parikirtitaha. Raji karma pala plepsuhu lubdha himsatmakaha ashuchihi harsha shoka anvitaha karta rajasaha parikirtitaha. Okay, so now we're doing the karta, that doership karta, which is called rajasa. So rajasic sense of doership. That really means that doership with a mind that's predominantly ruled by rajas. Okay. So here, ragi. Ragi comes from ragin. Ragin means the one who has raga. Raga is, when you say raga, it goes along with dvesha. If you say, if there's not anything, nobody has just raga. So if I say raga, I mean raga dvesha. So raga means, you know, your likes, your passions, the things that, the pravrittis, the things I want this so that I can be happy. I want this thing. This will be pleasing to me. This will make a difference in my life. This will make me happy. Dvesha is, this has got to go. These have to go. This person has to go. This situation has to go. The situation, this person, this thing cannot be in my life. That's the negative, right? That's the dvesha, hatred, dislike, hatred, irritation of this whole gamut, this whole side of emotions. So the ragi is the one who is subject, who has these. These passions are what are guiding your behavior. You go toward, with energy, toward the things that you have projected your ananda on, and you go away from or become, you know, negative toward the things that you have projected your lack of ananda on. Okay, so that person is, that type of karta is a ragi. Karma pala prepsuhu. Prepsuhu means one who, a person who is motivated by, who desires the fruit of their action. I'm doing this action so that I can have this. You know, I want this, and so therefore I am doing this karma in order to gain this pala. The pala, the fruit of the action, is really the reason for which I'm doing the action. Whereas for karma yogi and mumukshu, that isn't true. I'm really doing the action because it is there for me to do. And I do it for antakarana shuddhi. I really do it with that ishvara arpana buddhi. That means ishvara, the Lord. Arpana, that worship or devotion to the Lord. So buddhi means your mind has that commitment to Bhagavan. I'm doing, and why? I'm doing this as my dharma. For this, if I have to give you a reason for it, for a jnani, there really isn't a reason for it, other than this is my dharma. This is what is here to be done. That's why I'm doing it. There's no other reason. For mumukshu, I am doing this for antakarana shuddhi. You know, I may want something else. I may have some tendencies to do something else, but my commitment is really to antakarana shuddhi. And to that ishvara arpana buddhi, where I do the dharma that is presenting itself to me to be done. And that's my sphere. That is what I choose to do. Sometimes what is there to be done is also what you would choose to do. It's also fun and enjoyable. There's no conflict between dharma and your fun, or dharma and the things you would love to do. There's no conflict. And so those things, there's no problem. That you're just doing what you want to do, and it's also what you should be doing. Right? So this, the problem comes in when there's a conflict between what you would like to do and what you should do. And that conflict, you know, creates a pull. And so for a mumukshu, then my range of behavior is always dharma first. Right? So dharma first. That's that ishvara, that's the commitment, and ishvara arpana buddhi. And these other things are sacrificed to dharma. And sacrifice because of understanding also. As we mature, even if we're not a mumukshu, as we mature And as your experience is assimilated, pleasure backed by a dharma is not a very happy thing. Mm. You know, and we learn that just experientially. You go after a pleasure, but you have to do an adharma to do it, to have that pleasure. You know, then that adharma puts a darkness on the pleasure. And after you've experienced that in this way and that way, you start to realize that the pleasure is not worth it. The pleasure is not worth it if adharma is involved. And we learn that through experience. So the world is a great teacher. Bhagavan is a great, great teacher. Because otherwise, say, as long as I get the pleasure, dharma, adharma, doesn't make any difference, just let me have the pleasure. And the universe supports that, then how we will ever learn? But the universe actually doesn't support it. As you do the adharma, there becomes kind of a sadness or a dullness or a hurt in your mind from doing the adharma. And that wrecks the pleasure. And so it's a good way that we're able to learn. So here, for the ragi, for a person who has this raga dvesha, what happens to that person is that this is the raga, I want this so that I can be happy, which means that if I don't get this, I won't be happy. Right? And so therefore that pala, the thing that I'm going after, is very, very important to me, because it's really not okay for me not to be happy. That's really, you know, it's really not. Now, just think the little bit of complexity there. I am perfectly willing to be temporarily unhappy for my happiness, for the sake of my happiness. But I'm not willing to be unhappy, period. We make sacrifices and we do things that are hard for the sake of our well-being, right? But what if you haven't recognized that sometimes you sacrifice, you know, for a greater good? Okay, we don't recognize that. Then if this object holds that type of importance for you, then your raga is going to be ruling. The raga itself will rule, because nothing else is mitigating it. Dharma is not mitigating it. You know, for another person, a more mature person, dharma rules. Right? Because the dharma, I can give up the pleasure and still be happy and full and complete because I followed dharma. And the other way around doesn't work. I've understood that. Right? But what if I haven't understood that? Is there a person who we say has that rajasa kartrutvam, doesn't have that type of viveka? For them, that pola, the karma pola, is what is important, because I need that to be happy. So that's the drive there. And the negative is to get rid of the things that don't make me happy. So for such a person, they also have a tendency to have this lubdha. Lubdha is greed. By greed, as Shankara talks about it, Swamiji in his commentary also, greed is really, I don't want just what I have, I want what you have also. Yeah, it's a needing more, needing to have more than what just you need. That's greed. I want more. I want what you have and what you have. I want it all. Mm-hmm. That's the greed. And then he goes on, Shankara goes on to say, also that greed is a type of miserliness comes. That's also a type of greed. Like he uses the example, for instance, if you go to a tirtha. Tirtha is when you're taking a pilgrimage and you go to places of pilgrimage. It's traditionally what you do in those places of pilgrimage is that you give dhanam, charity. You give in those places. And there's many places where you're expected to give charity. But somebody who has this lubdha can't part with their money or their finances or their wealth, even in those places where it's expected, they won't give. Also, himsatmakaha. The himsatmaka means that the person, as Shankara, is there something kind of interesting here? Parapitakara sobhavaha. Parapitakara. It means that they cause injury, they inflict pain on others. So if somebody who's rajasic can be, you know, somebody who inflicts pain on others, you can inflict pain verbally, you can inflict pain mentally, emotionally. There's a lot of ways to inflict pain. There's a lot of ways that you can be violent toward another person. So a rajasic person can be very cruel. So himsatmaka means they have a tendency to cruelty, to inflicting pain on others when they don't get their way. Yeah, I just wonder, even your anger can be so cutting and so biting. You know, and what's interesting, I mean, I'm sure all of us have anger, but what's important as a sadhana is to remember what it's like for you when somebody is angry at you. Because when you're angry at somebody else, you are, what do you call it, releasing pressure. And so in the release of the pressure, you get some comfort and relaxation as you turn the other person into a puddle on the floor. By your releasing that pressure, where you can strike out and say things that shouldn't be said, or say things that are actually cruel, that are actually mean, you get some release of pressure from that. Yeah. And so in the release of pressure, you are blinded to the pain that you're causing the other person. And so I think one of the best ways around this is to contemplate on all of the experiences that you've ever had when somebody has released that pressure upon you. I think pressure, the use of the word pressure is a really good word. Because pressure, when you say something or you act out in a way, it's because there's pressure inside pushing you to act that way. And you don't know how to contain that pressure. You know, it's like a cork wants to, in a pressure cooker, you know, the pressure cooker, for those of us who use pressure cookers, you know, that pressure valve, you know, the pressure builds and the pressure valve goes off and then the steam shoots out, right? So we're like that. The pressure builds up, you know, and it builds up and it builds up and then it shoots out. And when it shoots out, you feel some relief. And you have no consciousness, usually, about what you're doing to the other person. It's very interesting. So you have to start to become conscious of that pressure. When that pressure is starting to take place inside of you, you have to become conscious of it. And then take an action, like take a walk. Or go do something, go talk to yourself by yourself in the bathroom or something. But I'm just saying, you have to become conscious of it. The reason you have to become conscious of it is because you get some relief from the release of pressure. That's why these people who are, you know, child abusers and wife beaters and, you know, get people who become very violent and rageful, they are releasing pressure, and there's some pleasure in it. You see what I'm saying? And that's what stops you from that's what stops you from understanding what's happening and what you're doing to the other person. So that's that himsatmaka, Atmaka, they have a nature of himsa. It's their nature to do this himsa. Because of the buildup of pressure, which is caused by the raga dvesha. Too many likes and dislikes, and I need this to be happy, and I'm not getting it. The pressure is building up, and then I spew. You know? And then the other person or whoever is getting that rage is just devastated, and you've spewed, and now you're fine, and you're wondering what's wrong with this person who's, you know, needs to be wiped up off the floor. You know? Because you're over it now. You're over it. This goes on. This is life. This is how. And so the thing, this life for all of us. You can't, nobody can say that they've never had this pressure. But pressure is a good word. You have to look for that pressure inside, and then your sadhana has to kick in. Okay, when I feel this pressure, I have to learn how to contain it and work with it, rather than letting it spew out like a pressure cooker. It's a big thing, really. But that's rajas. Rajas means, you know, rajas is angry, assertive, you know, energy. It's forceful, aggressive energy. That is rajas. You know, so when that energy is there, then we want to transform it into something that is less violent. Rajas can be very violent. You know, can also help you to run fast, you know, and to think and to be active. It can also be very violent. And so it has to be worked with. Asuchihi, another one, asuchihi. Asuchi is impurity. Impurity can be, you know, just you don't take a bath. That type, you don't wear clean clothes. Swami uses this example. And, you know, in India's hot. And so most people, and they take a nap in the afternoon. So usually you take a bath in the morning. Then you take your afternoon nap, and then you take a bath for the afternoon. You always put in fresh clothes. So you have two sets of clothes. Morning clothes after his bath, and afternoon clothes after his bath. So some people don't take baths, and then they put perfume on their body to try to cover it up. That doesn't work. Okay. That doesn't work either. Okay. So that asuchi, external, right? External asuchi. Internal, it's called bahya. Bahya asuchi is external. Lack of cleanliness, lack of clean clothes. Another thing, you know, in India, that wearing clean, fresh clothes is much more, I think because of the climate and things, much more important. Clean, fresh clothes every day. Internal antara asuchi means all of the negative spectrum of emotions that are really generated by raga dvesha. You know, like when you need something out here in order for you to be happy, then all of the negative emotions are automatically generated toward anyone and anything that gets in your way. That's all you need. It's a law. Whatever gets in your way to the fulfilling of one of these ragas. Remember you have to think of raga dvesha, you have to remember the whole template. It's I need this, I want this, so that I can be happy. That's the template for a raga. I want to get rid of this so that I can be happy. That's dvesha. So there's a lot at stake. When you think raga dvesha, there's a lot at stake there. And so say somebody is messing with your happiness. That's what it is. They are messing with your happiness. They're doing something they're becoming an obstruction to your well-being. And so when somebody is categorized like that, your mind is not going to think, what a wonderful person that is. You know? That person becomes the evildoer, You know, that person generates the whole negative gamut of emotions. You know, as long as the raga is there, you know. For a mumukshu, that raga is not there in the same form, because you no longer believe that. You no longer believe that your ananda is external like that, that it's actually, your ananda is actually located somewhere out here. The shining ananda, you know, the shining special magical ball of ananda that we're all after, as though it exists out here really. The mumukshu is the one who has recognized that, that isn't, it's simply not true. When I recognize that this raga dvesha, the strength of this raga dvesha, is very much mitigated by your knowledge. And now the commitment is not to raga dvesha, it's not to karmapala, it's to dharma, ishvara arpana buddhi for the sake of antakarana shuddhi. Because I don't buy into that anymore. And I don't care about it. I don't even care about it. That's the mumukshu, you know. But we're not talking about a mumukshu here. We're talking about the parts of us that are not yet in the mumukshu. So say you're 80% mumukshu, but you've got 20% of this left of these other things hanging around there. So there's the asuchi. And then harsha shokan vitaha. That means the one who, based on the raga dvesha, has harsha and shoka. Harsha means joy, horripilation, where you're You're so happy that the hairs on your body are standing on end. That's harsha. You're so excited, you're so elated when you've fulfilled the desire, you've gotten your way, and everything is so wonderful, and I am so elated and happy. And shoka is the dejection, the misery, when you have not gotten your way. You are miserable, unhappy, angry, frustrated, depressed. Life is not good for me. That's shoka. So your emotional system is going through these extremes of harsha, elation and dejection, based upon your success in fulfilling these karmapalas, the objects of your desire. Right? And so the harsha shoka, it's actually, we don't want the harsha shoka. It's too extreme. We should be able to have some sort of containment for our happiness and our dejection. You know, like things can go very well and you can be very happy about that. But there's a lot of things that have gone into that, everything going well in this particular time. You know, and if things don't go well, it's okay. It's not like things in the world don't always go well. And so this harsha and shoka become very much mitigated. It's not that you don't feel pleasure, and not that you don't feel disappointment as a mumukshu. But it doesn't mean much. Now, it's something that you contain. It's not as though, see, this is the thing. It's not as though what you're after in life is pleasurable emotions or the lack of unhappy emotions. That's not what I'm seeking at all. I'm seeking the ananda of my own being that does never comes and goes and it never changes. I'm not seeking pleasurable emotions or sad emotions. Those are totally secondary. It's not what I'm looking for as a mumukshu. I want my mind just to simply revel in and enjoy an ananda, the ananda of myself that never comes and goes. And whether the mind is enjoying some form of harsha, enjoyment or satisfaction or pleasure from a happy situation, or some form of dejection from something not going well, both of those emotional states take place in the ananda of myself. So I'm the constant refuge. And so that's what's meaningful. That's the wholeness. That's the fullness. The wholeness and the fullness is not a mental state. I don't really care about the mental states. It doesn't matter. whatever the mental state is, I'm its self. So that's when, like, when we do the meditation and we say, you know, let your own presence come to the forefront. Don't try to stop your mind from thinking this or thinking that. Don't worry about that. Just let your own presence come to the forefront. Or we can say like this, whatever thoughts are going on in your mind, whatever feelings are going on in your mind, right? Let them take place in a buddhi, that is, in relaxed, enjoying your own presence. Because then these things don't matter. It is not a deal breaker. It doesn't hurt you. And so that you're not running around with only sukha vrittis. Nobody's running around with only sukha vrittis. Not even a mahatma. And a mahatma is not trying to run around with just sukha vrittis. It makes no difference. Because your being is stable. And the being that you are is completely full. That just has to be recognized. Your being is not going to become full. It already is that. You can't do anything about it. You can't make it full, and you can't make it incomplete either. You just simply have to recognize the fact of what's already there. And what is there is so whole and complete. That's it. Moksha is already the accomplished fact of the self. That's why moksha, this whole idea of liberation, is only knowledge. It has nothing to do with doing something. It is only knowledge. Antakarna Shuddhi, gaining this purity of mind, has to do with doing something. Because I have to change these grooves and these habits. I make these changes based upon my knowledge. Right? And I do it because my mind is behaving in a way that is not true to reality. And so I just bring it home and I teach it like you would teach a little child. You teach your mind how to be in light of what you know. And just like you teach a child, when you're teaching the child, you teach a child so many things as it's growing up so that it can function well in the world. And so once you have knowledge, your mind that has been for beginningless lifetimes soaked in ajnanam, more than soaked, way underwater in ajnanam, right? Now it's picked up some ways of being in the world that are just based in ajnanam. They're natural, they're based in ignorance, in self-ignorance. And so the mind goes on, even though you know it goes on habitually behaving in these ways, and you just help it, you just bring it back. Or if there's trauma inside, inner child, you do inner child work. If there's trauma inside, because there will be, for all of us, there's some trauma. So you have to do inner child work and take care of that. There's some ways of being in the world that are hurtful and problematic. We have to take care of that. Why? What? Just based on our knowledge, we're not going to let our mind be hitting its head against the wall for no reason. You want to help. It's just being kind. You're kind to others, but you have to be kind to yourself also. So even that's a big thing to realize. It shouldn't be even a question. But for all of us, it is a question. I mean, we never thought of it that way often. You're kind to other people and you're kind to yourself also. No, I'll be kind to everybody else except me. That is weird. Mm-hmm. And it's very odd. Mm-hmm. But and it only becomes odd once it's said, and you say, well, yeah, that is very strange. So that's the rajas. That's good enough. We'll do tamas. We'll save tamas for next week. swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahi saha go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yam kshobharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate om shanti 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 hari om shri gurubhyo namaha hari om
being like kind to others and might not be kind to oneself. I mean, if one looks at oneself more objectively, that's just another human being. So if you can be kind to this human being, you can also be kind to this human being also.
Yeah, that's why you would think so, right? Mm. That we would be a given, but it's the same type of a blind spot where everybody's always conscious about how, like in a group, everybody in the group affects you, right? Obviously, we don't have a second thought about it, but you don't realize that you also affect everybody in the group. It's as though everybody affects you, but you're not really here to affect anybody else. Yeah. It's interesting how we can have those blind spots.
One thing that was Swamiji showed was very important when Swamiji would sort of say, okay, have a look at Ishwara, and then he would sort of bring a mirror and sort of have a look at Ishwara, and that was such a big recognition that, you know, one usually doesn't sort of look upon, you know,
this body
as Ishwara, and when Swamiji says, you know, yeah, have a look at Ishwara, and it's such a a big.
Maybe we should make a list of blind spots.
So Jake, you actually had a real mirror?
Yes, real mirror.
I haven't heard him do that, but it's very nice.
Very interesting.
Because there's nothing that's not Ishwar. You're as much Ishwar as anything else, yeah.
Such a, like an aha moment as you describe it.
Yeah.
Wow.
If some of these wrong attitudes have been existing for lifetimes, and you see the truth of the falsity of them, will that really burn them to ashes? Or?
Well, that's the start of the fire. You know, when, that's the beginning of the end. Once your knowledge and relationship to a given thing rises, then even though there might be some habitual behavior, it really can't last, because it's that habitual behavior is rising into somebody who knows differently now. And so even though it may go on for some time, it can't go on for that long. Swamiji often say that's the beginning of the end. I think it's the beginning of the end. Because there's consciousness there. with a different value system. Some hurts inside take longer. You know, some things are easily fall off, easily change. Other things are a little bit more deeply rooted. Pains and hurts and traumas.
And Radha, that could be a parabdha karma too, right?
Well, the parabdha karma at least will put you in the situation. Right.
Resolve all of these.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, say you're born in a certain place, a certain time, certain parents, certain siblings, certain school that you go into, the general physical reality, certain body with certain physical capacities and limitations. That's all the prarabdha karma. And then your mind is experiencing all of that, assimilating, reacting, learning as the prarabdha karma unfolds. So that's where you're learning and assimilating your experiences. But the experiences that are there for you to learn from are the prarabdha karma. The prarabdha karma is more than just this body. The body, mind, sense organs is of course the prarabdha karma, but the surrounding also that it finds itself in. So the experiences that are coming your way also are the prarabdha karma. And so your freedom has more to do with how you assimilate those experiences and how you respond. You know, that's where we have the most free will.
On the response.
How you respond to the life that is here, yeah.
And that's like saying you do the best you can what's presented to you from moment to moment.
Yeah.
Dharma.
I do my dharma, yeah. That's for mumukshu. I mean, that's for somebody who's held within kind of the Vedic religion or something in a spiritual setting. Dharma is important, you know.
But you're not doing that really for the other. You're doing that for yourself so that you can hold your understanding. And
you're doing it for antakarana shuddhi. You know, but you're also doing your, if you're following dharma, the other person is important. You know, the others in the situation are very important in the whole idea of dharma. In fact, the ahankara is less, becomes much less, and what becomes much more is Ishwara.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I have a question about, I think a follow-up for this. I was reading about Maya, and one of the readings he gave me, and this Swami, I don't remember his name, was saying that there is the pure Maya and the impure Maya. And he was defining them as impure Maya being the individual body, mind, sense organ, and the pure Maya being that, I think, Ishwara or that.
What was the book? Oh, never mind, I'll tell you what they're talking about.
Okay. So, I just want to know
what they're talking about?
I want to know. Why is Ishwara, which is objective experience of the world with Brahman, why is it called Maya? Since Maya is, I think it means illusion, you know?
See, yeah, English is a big problem.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
you can clarify that.
Illusion, even the word illusion for Maya is a problem. Like, don't use that word, illusion. When they say the Maya, pure and impure Maya. That's, I don't know who you're reading, but this is probably what they're translating. For Ishwara, we say Maya has two capacities. One is avarna, one is vikshepa. Avarna means the capacity to cover. Vikshepa is the capacity to project. So for Ishwara, Maya only has the vikshepa. There's only projection because there's no ajnanam. There's nothing to cover because it's infinite. So Maya is absolutely pure of ajnanam. So ajnanam, ignorance, which causes all of the other impurities like kama, krodha, desire, anger, kartritvam, doership, bhoktritvam, all of the enjoyership, all of these things, the ahankara, everything, comes from ajnanam. Ajnanam is the avaranam, is the covering. So for the jiva, maya covers. Maya creates the ajnanam for the jiva because the mind and sense organs are limited and they only look outward, and so everything that you know is limited by the limitations of the mind and the sense organs. So maya covers the jiva, whereas for Ishvara, the vikshepa, the projection, is not covering anything because it's infinite. There's no ajnanam anywhere. There's no covering anywhere because it's I am the whole. So for Ishvara, there's no problem. There's nothing covering Brahman. There's nothing, there's no limitation. It's not like I'm one thing and not the other. I'm everything and free of everything. So that's, so Brahman with the entire Maya, you know, the infinite Maya, like the manifest Maya would be the manifestation of infinite knowledge. There's, that's what they're calling the pure Maya, just vikshepa. The impure Maya is what we call ajnanam for the jiva. So though those terms, I'd like to see the Sanskrit that they're actually translating.
Okay. So a good translation for Maya would be projection of infinite creation, of infinite knowledge.
What if you say Maya is that creative, the creative capacity of Ishvara, of Brahman, or the the creative capacity of Brahman.
Yes.
Yeah.
That works better.
Yeah.
So, yes, because I don't understand why it's translated as illusion.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's because Maya, they use the word illusion, but they shouldn't, because the reason they shouldn't use it is because illusion is a loaded word.
Yeah.
Because if I talk about an illusion, I'm having, it's an ephemeral thing that I can project and withdraw. And so what happens is, if I use the word illusion for Maya, then I think I'm projecting it and withdrawing it. It's my illusion. So that's why it becomes a dangerous word, because whereas actually I can say that I have my own little piece of Maya, like I can project a snake on a rope, I can project a dream, I can project an imagination. That's all that Maya capacity. But then if you think the world is Maya, then I'll think, and I'm really projecting this. But then you're talking about the jiva. That's where it gets, and the word illusion becomes problematic. So what we have to understand is just, there's a lot of things that have to be understood when we use these words, have to be understood. So if we're talking about the different orders of reality, we'd say that Brahman enjoys absolute reality in that it is non-dual and not ever subject to negation. It can't be negated in past, present, future. What Brahman is, it is, it's free of time. That's what we call absolute reality. Okay? Maya does not enjoy that absolute reality. Maya is what we call mithya. It is dependent on Brahman for its being. Everything in Maya comes into being and goes out of being. But because it comes into being and goes out of being and doesn't enjoy absolute reality that we call satyam, some people will translate it as illusion. That's why. But we shouldn't. We should just say it enjoys dependent reality, which is a translation of mithya. That which can't be categorized as absolute reality, satyam, and we can't say it's not there. We say it's a dependent reality. And now, in this world of dependent reality, that of maya that we call mithya, okay, there is the jiva and its jiva's projections that we call pratibhasika, which means subjective projections. And there's Ishvara's projection that we call vyavaharak, Vyavaharika, empirical reality. This is empiric, the whole creation is an empirical shared reality where science and mathematics and all these laws and order exist, of which this jiva is a part of that. Right? So we're not going to call Vyavahara, empirical reality, as an illusion.
Exactly.
That's why it's a bad word.
Yeah.
Right? We will call Pratibhasika as an illusion. You know, that's what we usually do call it. Because say, oh, my dream is an illusion. It's not the best word still. Mm. You know, or my projection of a snake on a rope, that's an illusion. Still, it's a little, not quite the right word, because illusion is usually a word that's like for schizophrenics or, you know, or magic.
Like magic.
Or magic tricks. And tricks and magic and that type of thing. But it's okay to use. I mean, but if we say this creation is like an illusion, but we have to, it's dangerous. If you're going to say that, you have to teach a lot about exactly what you mean by that.
It gives the wrong message.
Gives the wrong message, yeah.
To me, it means that it's not real.
Yeah.
You know?
But you see what I mean? If you say it's not real, this is why words are so important. You have to be able to define what you mean by real.
Right. What order of real?
Yes, exactly. What order of real? So there's Paramarthika Satyam, absolute reality. Vyavaharika Satyam, empirical, shared reality. Pratibhasika Satyam, subjective reality.
Right.
So if you say not real, you mean it's not Paramarthika. It's not absolute reality. What do you mean by absolute reality? Can never be negated at any time.
No, it's very clear.
Words. Yeah.
Thanks.
Michael?
I can understand how when Mokshu is motivated to do Dharma, there's a clear purpose.
Yeah.
To it. And but for the Yani, I know you've said many, many times that it's natural. They just do what they naturally do is Dharma. But
Dharma is natural to your being. Because Dharma is, say that the overarching word for Dharma is ahimsa, non-injury. You know, let me not hurt. And the vow of sannyasa is abhayam. May no being be afraid of me, and may I not be afraid of any being. Ahimsa, non-injury. There is no pravritti, you know, no inclination to injure another person when you have a shantavritti. When you are at peace, when your mind is at peace, when that ajnanam is not there, causing raga dvesha, these likes and dislikes, when you're just at abiding at peace, there is no inclination to do an adharma, because that adharma would involve hurting in some way or another person. And what would be the inclination? Why? You get rid of the source of the adharma, which is ajnanam. That's why. It's not in your nature. It's in the nature of ajnanam to do adharma. Only in the sense that you've projected your well-being onto an object, and then other people are getting in the way of you getting that object, which brings about pressure in the form of anger or rage or all of these negative emotions that come, that are generated because these people are in the way of your getting what you want. Say you don't want anything, then nobody's getting in the way. You know?
I guess the exception would be the emotional lag time.
That's right. Okay. That's right, exactly. That's why the emotional lag time is our sadhana.
Hmm.
Yeah. We have the, otherwise we don't... You have knowledge, boom, everything's fine. But now you have knowledge, and then your mind is continues to act like you don't. You know, even though you know, it habitually behaves in this way. There's also inner work, child work, and all of that. And all it all falls off in time. But there are also ways of being with your mind and helping your mind that expedites that whole process. It makes a difference. And to know how to do inner child work, to know how to pull your mind back, you know, to know how to be with your mind in a way that allows it to transform itself more quickly, to grow and to drop off hurtful ways of being. There's a lot to know that's helpful.
Some of the habits can be so strong too.
They can be, yeah. Some of the hurts can be strong and tenacious also. And they don't just go away. I think there's some hurts and traumas that never go away.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But they leave thin scars instead of pussy ones.
What do they do?
They leave thin scars instead of, you know, pussy infected wounds. I think those are our character lines. Those are our wrinkles.
Even for a nyani?
Yes, absolutely. Those are the wrinkles, you know? Your character.
You said another time that, like, the face that got completely repaired with no marks, that it's also possible to get completely free, maybe for some people, of all the emotional stuff, just not have that.
My, that's exactly what I said was, you know, the pain can go, but the recognition of that is there. Like a scar doesn't really cause pain, but the scar is there. Like what if the scar has gone through some different stages? Like say you have a deep cut, say the cut is infected, it hurts, it's throbbing. You're always having to pay attention to it. It's always calling your attention. You know, it doesn't just leave you. It's always beckoning you. It's always, you know, it needs to be loved and cared for and bandaged. But eventually, it heals, and then it even heals more to the point that it's a light scar, but that light scar is still there. It's not like you to forget.
The scar is actually proof of successful healing.
Yeah. Yes, successful healing. The thing is your memory isn't wiped clean, you know. Things happen.
Yeah, because you said the pain would be gone. Yeah.
So that's that famous example that's not a Vedantic example. It was used by a psychologist of imagine two beautiful of these Chinese vases that are, you know, vases that are big. They're like this. You know, very, very expensive, highly intricate, made of fine china, and one of them was kicked over, knocked over, and smashed into smithereens, you know, and the other one was never touched at all, but they brought in a master, you know, craftsman, came and put that vase back together so that really the naked eye, you could take a magnifying glass to it probably, but you really couldn't tell at all, you know, but the vase knew, you know. You know, it was fun, you know, but it had an experience that the other face didn't have, yeah. And that experience has value. What we call, you know, empathy and compassion and depth of understanding, and so it's like your character. Life isn't easy. People don't just grow up as this vase. There are no, this vase represents no one. This is a hypothetical vase.
It's an illusion.
And this vase also wouldn't be very, be kind of awkward to know. This one you can relate to, because they will be able to relate to you.
It's one of us. Yeah.